We're continuing to dig into the scriptures, some of the passages that challenge you most. We're looking at them today on The Line of Fire.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey friends, welcome back to The Line of Fire. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. Yesterday, if you tuned into the broadcast, you know that I was en route to India as you were watching. Like, how did you do that? It didn't look like you were on an airplane. No, we pre-recorded the broadcast so that we could have a quality, fresh, new broadcast for you as I was traveling to India for my annual trip over there, trip number 27. Well, as you're watching today's show, listening to today's show, I'm still en route. Yeah, from door to door, it's about 40 hours, including one night in Mumbai. So you fly into India, arrive there past midnight, spend the night there, fly out the next morning to the next destination. So a total of like 4 or 5 flights to get there. In any case, still traveling. So you think that's, yeah, a lot of traveling, done it a bunch of times, but it's a calling and there's grace to do it. And I dearly, dearly love my friends in India. So it's a way of just showing solidarity and support. But please pray for grace, for strength, for every day we have together to be of the highest quality, for God's purposes to be accomplished. All right, I'm not taking calls. What I'm doing is continuing to answer some really excellent questions that I asked for a few days ago on Facebook and Twitter, asking what are the passages that challenge you the most, that cause you the most problems, that you wonder about. So we're digging into them. Before I start, though, let me strongly encourage you to check out Fire School of Ministry online. Yeah, it is fireschoolofministry.com. That's the online address, fireschoolofministry.com. The entire program that we taught for over 22 years, live and in person, with extraordinary faculty, with an amazing team, with people anointed and called and graced, with a great track record of people who've been taught and trained in the ministry school, now sent all over the world doing amazing, effective missions work and church planting work and humanitarian work and mass evangelism work and media work and all kinds of other things. You can sit in these same classes, all right? The exact same classes. I'm talking about high quality audio lectures of the full classes, not just an abbreviated online version, along with comprehensive study guides, ministry practicums, so you get the full benefit in the privacy of your home at your own pace. And when you're done, you'll have earned an Associate of Practical Ministry degree, but you can then transfer those credits, transfer them over, say, to the King's University if you want to keep studying there. Folks that have started with us have gone on to all kinds of advanced degrees by starting there, then transferring credits into another school, so you can do that, or get the full benefit of the program at your pace for your purposes. And then we also have times where different faculty will come on. I'll come on and we'll do a Q&A night with students and things like that where we all come together via Zoom. So find out about it. Go to fireschoolofministry.com. Get your application in today. All right. We go back over to Facebook questions. And Lauren says this: I grew up Jewish and hated the reading of the Binding of Isaac every Rosh Hashanah. So Rosh Hashanah, Feast of Trumpets in the Bible, becomes the Jewish New Year. So you read the Binding of Isaac, Genesis 22. I still find it appalling and troubling. Yes, I know it's a foreshadowing of Christ, but still, as a child, I wondered, what if Abraham heard wrong? What if my parents thought they heard the same thing? Another thing I find horrifying, actually, is the ending of the Book of Esther, the Revenge Massacre. Sometimes I wonder if the reason God is not mentioned in that book is that he was ashamed of their actions. There are a lot of disturbing narratives in the Bible, some hard for me to reconcile, but my faith in God remains solid. Lauren, I'm glad your faith overall remains solid. These are honest questions, especially growing up as a child, the way things in the Bible can sound and seem. So thank you for posting these. When it comes to Genesis 22, the binding of Isaac, what we have to remember is that Abraham was God's man on the planet at that moment. It wasn't just any Tom, Dick, or Harry. Abraham was specially chosen by God. That's one. Two, in the ancient world, it was common for people to sacrifice their children to the deity for various reasons, part of the proof that these were demons, that this was idolatry and destructive. But this was God's way of shouting to the world, no, this is not who I am. This is not what I am about. I do not want you to do this. This was even stronger than a law saying, don't sacrifice your children. Don't pass them through the fire to Molech or anything like that. Don't do that. Yes, the Bible has that legislation clearly, but this was God's way of shouting it to the world. Now, by the way, there's a total difference between human sacrifice and the Son of God laying his life down on our behalf. It would be like one soldier in a battle saying, all right, I'm going to keep the enemy occupied here until you all get out, knowing that he's going to die in the process, laying down his life for a cause, or someone, a leader in a city when the city is captured and they're going to kill everyone saying, take my life. Take my life instead. I know I'm of value to you. Take my life. So that is completely different than someone offering up a child in human sacrifice. But this was God's way of saying to Abraham and to the world, I do not want this. I am different than these other deities. And God was not going to let anything happen to Isaac. That's the other thing. So anyone claiming to hear that or thinking they're hearing that now, it couldn't be God because it's contrary to what he has revealed in his word. Just like if someone felt God was telling them to commit adultery. No, that's not what he's ever saying. He's given his once for all revelation on that in scripture. As for the book of Esther, no, I'm quite sure that God's name is not mentioned there because he's ashamed of the actions of his people. His name is not mentioned there to illustrate that he is at work supernaturally, even when it is not visible and open, that he is absolutely at work, even when it's not shouting from the sky, this is the voice of God and the action of God. Yet he moves in some of the clearest possible ways in the book of Esther, the clearest manifest ways of his presence, of his actions, of his intervening in history, indisputably seen there. And yet without his name being mentioned, it's how life often is. You see the hand of God without seeing him at work in a face-to-face way, so to say. But the revenge killing, I wouldn't look at his revenge killings as much as there are people that want to kill us, and this is our time to kill them. It's just like in war and battle. Look, I've never been a soldier, but there are times when we'd all agree it is righteous to defend yourself. It is righteous to defend your family. So let's just say that ISIS had gotten permission to go around killing all the Jews in this particular region. And something happened and the Jews were now given weapons to defend themselves and they killed the ISIS members. Nobody would complain about that in terms of righteousness. Like, well, those terrorists got what they deserve. I look at it the same way here. All right, Wesley, the passages which deal with Elohim sharing his... Oh, I covered that one yesterday. Deborah, Hebrews 11:35, the faith chapter. Women received their dead back to life, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, so they might attain a better resurrection. So, if we suffer for our faith, as many are in other countries right now, we will have more rewards in the kingdom. You never hear this taught, but maybe it should be. It might happen soon, things like being put in prison, mocking, persecution, murdered, martyred, but I find it challenging to think I would actually be strong enough to choose it. Yes, Deborah, first thing is, in point of fact, if someone denied the Lord, turned their back on the Lord, and proved unfaithful versus someone that honored the Lord and refused to denounce him. Yes, the person that honored the Lord and refused to denounce him would receive, quote, a better resurrection than the person who denounced him and betrayed him. One stayed faithful, the other walked away. Jesus said, if you deny me before men, I'll deny you before the angels in heaven and before my Father. If you confess me, I'll confess you. So we see those things, those larger truths. But then even within the Lord, yes, there will be rewards, okay? It's true, and it is something that is taught clearly in Scripture in different parables and the fact that we'll stand before the judgment seat of Messiah. And it's not judged in terms of do we go to heaven or hell if we are believers, but rather judged in terms of accountability. It's a serious thing. I remember when Leonard Ravenhill had a stroke in September of 1994, we were very close. And he was old and frail at that point, 87 years old, and had multiple injuries and sicknesses and things. So he was very frail, had a stroke, and never came out of the coma, went to be with the Lord in November of 94. So it was over 2 months. I don't have the exact chronology, but over 2 months, I believe, that he was in a coma. And he loved the Lord deeply. He had a very, very rich, deep, personal, intimate relationship with Jesus, prayed hours in communion with the Lord deeply every single day. And I remember his wife, Martha, saying to me, well, this is good. This will give him time to prepare his heart before the judgment seat. Like, that's how seriously they took these things of one day we will give account to God. So, yes, God in his goodness gives us salvation as a gift, but as his children, there are rewards that can be earned. And you say, well, is that fair? Of course it's fair, it's righteous, it's good, but some would also say that we will each receive to the full measure of our capacity. In other words, depending on how we walk with the Lord in this world, we'll have a certain capacity for God in the next, and we each receive to the fullness of that capacity. I mean, people have looked at it from different ways. Others say the rewards pertain to the millennial kingdom. Either way, by all means, we should be talking about being strong in the Lord in the face of persecution. It's a theme we talk about constantly, have for decades. Not only so, face the fact that in yourself you won't be strong enough. Just accept that and learn to lean on grace. Accept the fact that in yourself, in your own resolve, that there's enough pressure that can come against you, enough satanic attack that you'll crumble, I'll crumble, we'll collapse. Just accept that. Say, but God, you make me strong. You know I want to serve you. You know I want to honor you. You know, God, more than anything, I want to be faithful and loyal. I want to see you exalted. Lord, you know that more than anything, that's my desire. And you know, Lord, deep down, that's my heart cry. So strengthen me. Give me grace. And then every day, do what you know how to do to walk in obedience today. Be obedient in the little. It'll be a lot easier to be obedient in the big. Obey him when the pressure is small. It'll be a lot easier to obey him when the pressure is very, very large and heavy and intense. And it's just like working out, working out a little bit more each day. Soon enough, you're doing things you didn't think you could do because your body's gotten in better shape. Get in the habit spiritually of walking in obedience. Get in the habit spiritually of standing for the Lord. So here, it might be right now that your test is to say what you believe is right graciously and honorably, but to say what you believe is right, and you lose some friends on Facebook. And it stings a little. I know it's little, but it stings a little. It's rejection. Oh, feel rejected. Or people blast you. Say, Lord, okay, good. This is my opportunity. This is my training ground. A little bit here, a little bit there, so that when real persecution, opposition comes, I'll have been trained to stand and do what's right. Do what you can every day. Walk in that light and say, Lord, sustain me by your grace. Finish the good work that you started in me. All right, we're just getting started today. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey friends, as I am en route to India, even as you hear my voice, still traveling to India to our destination, it's about 40 hours door to door. As I'm doing that, you are listening to me. Well, it's live, you're listening, but this is a pre-recorded broadcast just recorded a few days ago, which means that we're not taking your phone calls, but I did solicit questions. I said, what are the passages in the Bible that trouble you? The issues that you really wonder about. Let's tackle these. Let's do some special shows. We know every Friday you've got questions, we've got answers, the phones ring off the hook, we're booked wall to wall. Sometimes every phone line is filled the moment the show starts. I mean, I look at the board and every phone line is already filled, and it'll stay like that the moment one phone line opens, boom, another. All that to say that it seems that you like to present your questions, and since our ministry has asked Dr. Brown, it seems like we enjoy answering your questions. And sometimes I'll be at home and we've had a full day of writing and ministry and radio and video recording and different things. And I'll be at home and just kind of sitting there at my computer writing. It's like, I want to talk to people. And I'll just get online on Facebook or something and say, hey, got questions? Post them here. I'd love to answer your questions. So we asked for these questions, and it seems to be something that's important to you to have these answered, important to me to give you answers. So let's keep diving in, but I won't be able to take your calls, as I'm sure you understand. Mitch posts a bunch of verses that cause him to wonder. 1 Kings 22:22, where the Lord asks one of the spirits how will you do this? How are you going to deceive Ahab? And the Spirit replied, I'll go out and inspire all of Ahab's prophets to speak lies. You'll succeed, said the Lord. Go ahead and do it. In Isaiah 45:7, I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. Isaiah 46:10, I make known the end from the beginning, from ancient times, what is still to come. I say, my purpose will stand. I'll do all that I please. Romans 9:13, just as it is written, Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated. Exodus 9:12, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not listen to Moses and Aaron, just as the Lord said to Moses. So verses that seem that God is either complicit with evil or behind evil or just arbitrary, verses that give that impression. With regard to 1 Kings 22:22, remember, God is the Lord over the entire world. God is the Lord over the entire angelic realm, the holy and the fallen. And it could very well be that God used a demonic spirit, a lying spirit, right? He sits enthroned, calls all of his created beings in the heavenly realms, in the spiritual realm, before him. All right, who's going to lead Ahab into battle? It's judgment time for him. He's going to reap what he sowed. Who's going to lead Ahab into battle? This one said this, this one, and one spirit said this. You got the job. You're a liar. Go ahead and lie. And this is exactly what God says. When you reject his true word, he'll give you delusion. That's a judgment. Okay, you won't hear the truth, then I'll give you over to lies. And it's a righteous judgment. Isaiah 45:7 is not translated correctly. The Hebrew there is not good versus evil, but peace versus disaster. Shalom and ra or ra'ah. So ra or ra'ah fundamentally means something bad. So if God does it, it's disaster judgment. If people do it, it's evil. All right, so it is not I make peace and create evil, but I make peace and create disaster. That's the contrast there. So God does not create evil. And yeah, Isaiah 46:10, his purposes will, there are things he will bring to pass. It doesn't mean everything that comes to pass on the earth is his will. No, why do you think he brings judgment and says, I'm displeased with you, or you've sinned against me, or you rejected my will or my counsel. But in the midst of it, he carries out his will. As for loving Jacob and hating Esau, notice that Romans 9 is not quoting from Genesis there. It's quoting from Malachi. All right, this is talking on a national level, how God chose Jacob for divine service and rejected Esau. It's not talking about individual salvation. And certainly not everyone in Jacob was saved. Not everyone in Esau was lost, speaking of Israel and Edom. As for God hardening Pharaoh's heart, I have two videos, a short one, maybe 3-4 minutes, and a longer one, about 9 minutes, going through every Hebrew reference in Exodus where it speaks of God hardening Pharaoh's heart. In short, Pharaoh hardens his heart over and over and over before God does anything. And then first, God just strengthens Pharaoh in his resolve. And then as it goes on further, then the hardness becomes more intense. But it is God's righteous judgment on a sinning leader, not his hardening of someone seeking to please him and honor him. It's all consistent with his behavior. Patricia, in John 6, Jesus tells his disciples to eat his body and drink his blood, since they were Jewish and forbidden to have anything with blood ingested. How could they read? Yes, yeah, so obviously the ones that didn't understand took him seriously, let alone drink the blood of an animal, drink the blood of a human, eat the blood of a human. It was 100% forbidden, be completely repulsive. There is nothing in Jewish custom, tradition, law that would let them get within a million miles of eating the flesh, drinking the blood of a human being, obviously. So the ones that were carnal, they just didn't get it. And Jesus keeps talking more spiritually and more spiritually, and they're still not getting it. So he goes even further. Listen, I'm telling you, my blood is drink indeed. My flesh is life indeed. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood is eternal life. Like, what are you talking about? And they all leave. And then Jesus says to his disciples, you're going to leave also? And they said, where are we going to go? You have the words of eternal life. And he says, what are you going to do when you see the Son of Man ascend to heaven? The flesh counts for nothing. It's the spirit gives life. The words that I speak to you, they are spirit and they are life. In other words, I'm not talking about my physical body. I'm not talking about that. He keeps trying. Read through John 6, and you'll see they come because they want more food. And he says, I'm the bread from heaven. Well, we want like the bread you gave us yesterday. That was good bread because we're hungry and we want more bread. And they're not getting it. So he keeps upping the ante to get them to think spiritually, to see spirit, but they're not getting it. All right. So that's the whole point. He couldn't be talking literally. And he's saying, hey, when I ascend to heaven, then how are you going to eat my flesh, drink my blood? You can't. I'm talking spiritually. And the disciples may not fully have understood it, but they ultimately get his point. Okay, you do not want us to eat your flesh and blood. By the way, it is a total wrong application of that passage to go a Catholic way and say that means when you take communion that you're literally eating his flesh and drinking his blood. It was never literally eating his flesh and never literally drinking his blood. It was spiritually partaking. Jeff is wondering about 2 Samuel chapter 12, verses 11 through 18. So 2 Samuel chapter 12, this is following the account of David's adultery. And verses 11 through 18, out of your own household, I'm going to bring calamity on you before your very eyes. I'll take your wives, give them to one who's close to you. He'll sleep with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret. I'll do this in broad daylight before Israel. David said to Nathan, I've sinned against the Lord. Nathan replied, the Lord's taken away your sin. You're not going to die. But because by doing this, you've shown under contempt for the Lord, the son born to you will die. And then it says, after all of David's praying and fasting, the child dies. I'm not sure exactly what in that passage is troubling to you, but it is an explicit judgment on David's act of adultery and murder. David sinned in horrific ways. David abused his power in horrific ways. David took the one wife of a faithful soldier and then had the guy killed because he was so faithful. It's a horrific account. It's a terrible stain on David's life and ministry. Nonetheless, God does forgive him. So yes, there are consequences of sin, but we can be forgiven. And then, of course, David and Bathsheba marry and have the child, who's Solomon, right? Yedidah, he's called beloved of the Lord. But tragically, Solomon follows in his father David's promiscuity in a much more severe way, with 300 wives and 700 concubines. And the foreign wives, Nehemiah 13 tells us, were his undoing. But all that being said, yeah, this is judgment on sin and yet forgiveness. We still sing the Psalms of David to this day. Let's see. Raphael, Luke 16, 1 through 13. Yeah, the parable of the unjust steward. It seems odd in that Jesus is using an example of a man who connives his boss. His boss is about to fire him. He thinks, okay, I need to make friends then. I'm not going to have money. And you know, I'm going to steal. What am I going to do when I get fired? So he goes to all the people with whom his boss has accounts, and these people owe his boss money. All right, you owe $10,000. Tell you what, listen, write a check for $5,000 today, and we forget about the rest. Really? Yeah, go ahead and do that. All right, what do you owe $50,000? You cut a check for $23,000 today, and we call it even. Really? It's cut that check, give it to my boss for even. Because he still had the authority to do that. So his boss commends him. It's like, what? What do you mean commended him? The guy was dishonest and he took some of your money. But the boss commends him for being wise and saying, hey, you were shrewd. You made yourself friends while you had the opportunity. So Jesus then says, well, you see, the children of the world, they are often wiser than the children of the light. So get shrewd. And what does he say? Use money for what purposes? Use money to make friends for eternity. So he's saying, look, if this guy could do this with his ingenuity and his human wisdom and his deception, how much more as children of light can we use the resources that we have and the material earthly resources for eternal purposes? So he's not encouraging us to be dishonest, but rather learn from that, see what the world does, then see what we can do to make friends through eternity. Obviously using money for gospel purposes. By the way, the parable ends with some very practical teaching. If you're faithful with little, you'll be faithful with much. If you're faithful with earthly things, you'll be faithful with spiritual things. If you're faithful with that which belongs to someone else, you'll be faithful with that which is given to you for yourself. All right, we'll cover more. Let's see what's coming next. Yeah, 1 John questions and some others. James versus Paul on justification. Exposition of Acts 15, help my unbelief. All right, bunch of good passages. We're going to look at more of your questions. Don't miss a single minute on this special broadcast, as I am en route to India. Stay tuned.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us on The Line of Fire. Michael Brown, as you hear my voice, I am en route to India. So right before leaving for India, we recorded some special broadcasts for you. So sit back, enjoy the show. The only thing we can't do is take your calls, or if there's breaking news, comment on that breaking news. However, even in India, I'm normally writing articles, and even while flying, writing articles. So be checking our website regularly, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org, to see our latest articles. Sometimes I'll even just post a video commentary on Facebook or something like that. So stay connected with us. Hey, do you get our emails? If you're not sure, you probably don't. Because every Monday, we'll send out a special announcement, sometimes some testimonies, sometimes a special resource package we've put together. We're just sharing my heart with you on Monday. On Wednesday, it's our video watch list. So not just the Line of Fire broadcast, but every new special video that we recorded, maybe a commentary on what's happening in politics or something to edify you or combating some anti-Semitic extremes, you know, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 7 minute videos. Wednesday, we let you know, hey, here are the videos for the last week in case you missed anything. And Friday, here are all the articles, normally about five articles a week, op-ed pieces, and you get them. And by the way, when you sign up for our email list, you automatically get our free ebook, Seven Secrets of the Real Messiah. It's a real neat read. It's stuff condensed from the real kosher Jesus that you'll find to be a real eye-opener. So do that. Sign up. You say, how do I do it? Just go to askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. You'll see it right there on the homepage. Take you, what, 30 seconds? Type your name, address, email. Boom. That's it. And this way we can stay in touch with you via email. All right. Back to some excellent questions that I solicited on Facebook before leaving for India. Rich, 1 John, several verses saying anyone who sins doesn't know God. For example, 1 John 3:9, yet we all sin after becoming believers. Yes. Number one, 1 John 1 says, if we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. 1 John 2, I write these things to you so that you will not sin. But if you do sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus, the Messiah, the righteous. 1 John 5, if you see your brother sin and it's not a sin unto death, pray for them. So 1 John is telling us we do sin as believers. However, 1 John 3, which says that you cannot sin if the seed of God remains in you, means you cannot continue in sin. You cannot continue to live in sinful, unrepentant obedience and be a child of God. If you do, you were either never saved or you've turned away from the Lord. It's just that simple. It's just like saying that if you stay in the sunlight, you will get burned. If you stay, and it's an inevitability. You cannot possibly stay constantly in the sunlight without getting burned. It's just, that's going to happen. Well, the same way, if the seed of God remains in you, God's light and life is within you, you cannot possibly live in persistent, rebellious, unrepentant sin, the pattern of your life. This is who you are. This is how you live. You can't live like that and serve God at the same time, have the seed of God within you. So either you've never known the Lord, if that's your lifestyle, or look, and that's different between saying, Lord, I'm messing up. Please help me. I hate the way I'm living. Help me. Give me grace. That's someone repenting and coming to God asking for help versus someone saying, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. I'm going to live how I want to live, period. End of subject. Totally different. The one that lives like that has either never known the Lord or they've turned away from God. By the way, I just finished teaching on 1 John. I just finished teaching on Hebrews also. And if you're one of our monthly torchbearers, you have access to these special bonus videos that we do every week. So those supporting us with $1 a day or more, $30 or more per month, you get access to a lot of stuff, special video on demand. We put out, as you know, thousands of free resources. We have an unbelievable amount of resources available to you absolutely free. But then we have some other material that our torchbearers can access. So if you join our support team, not only are you helping us touch the world, you're helping us stir revival in the church. You're helping us produce, by God's grace, moral and cultural revolution, gospel-based in our society. You're helping us reach the lost sheep of the house of Israel, revival in the church, revolution in society, redemption in Israel. You're helping us on every single front. Not only are you doing that as a torchbearer, but we pour back into you many special ways every month. Take a minute. If we've been a blessing to you as we come to the end of this year of 2019, if we've been a blessing to you, why not become one of our torchbearers, one of our team members? And by the way, if you join us in an Israel trip, I'm on my way to India, thinking India. If you join us in an Israel trip, our next one, May 2020, if you join us there, you get 10% off the fare as a torchbearer. So let's just say, theoretically, it's a $3,900 trip, right? So 10% off is $390. Let's say you're giving us $30 per month. That's $360. Basically, all the money you gave the whole month, the whole year, comes right off the trip. Yeah. So just another way of us saying thank you. So become a torchbearer today, especially if you're thinking of coming to Israel, right? Put the money right back in your own pocket. Give it to the Lord and get it right back, right? That works. So AskDrBrown.org, just click on donate and then monthly support, and you'll see a list of benefits, blessings that come your way. And then while you're on the website, find out about the Israel trip. We only have maybe 20-something seats left, something like that. All right, more of your questions. Sarah in 2 Samuel 16 through 19, obviously left the chapter up there, had the witch of Endor summon Samuel, which Samuel appeared and spoke to Saul. One, Saul should not have summoned Samuel, who is dead. Had explained that Saul spoke to Samuel and not to a demonic spirit. Right, so at the end of 2 Samuel, we have this account with the witch of Endor. Scholars continue to debate that. Did this witch literally call up Samuel from the dead? And it was the will of God that Samuel spoke prophetically to Saul in judgment. And that's why the witch is like, oh, what did you have me do? She thought she's going to do a normal conjuration. And here it's Samuel. No, gosh, it's not good. So she's shocked. Is that literally what happened? Or was the whole thing just a ruse? And it was a demon that came up and spoke, or a demon posing as Samuel? To me, my opinion, can't be dogmatic, but that it really was the spirit of Samuel called up from the dead, and that it was just part of divine judgment, that the witch did not have the power to do this. The witch did not have the power to communicate with the dead. It was simply something that God sovereignly did in judgment on Saul. So again, you could say, but that would never happen. We don't speak with the dead. Well, God could do whatever he wants to do. Moses and Elijah appear in the Mount of Transfiguration and speak with Jesus, but we are forbidden from trying to contact the dead or speak with the dead. The only thing you're going to get doing that is demonic spirits. Some would argue, well, it had to be a demonic spirit. It's possible. It's possible. Scholars debate it. Scholars debate it. All right. Peter, explanation of Acts 15, 15 through 18. Yes, sir. So in Acts 15, we have the council in Jerusalem, the question about what to do with Gentile believers. Do they have to become circumcised, the men? Does everyone have to come under the law of Moses, men and women? Once they come to faith in Jesus, the Jewish Messiah, no, it's you have to become Jews to be part of this community. And the answer is no. No, God has accepted them as Gentiles, and they are now equal citizens, equal heirs in God's family, in the ecclesia, in the messianic community, without having become Jews. The same way Jews don't have to become Gentiles, right? So it then says this, the words of the prophets are in agreement with this, as it is written, after this I will return and rebuild David's fallen tent. Its ruins I will rebuild and I will restore it, that the rest of mankind may seek the Lord, even all the Gentiles who bear my name, says the Lord who does these things, things known from long ago. Now, in context, Amos 9, which is being quoted here in Acts 15, is speaking of the future restoration of the Davidic kingdom, something that we look to in the millennial kingdom. That there will be an earthly manifestation of the glory of the God, the knowledge of the glory of the Lord covering the earth as the waters cover the seas. And that this will be a time of the nations of the world, Isaiah 2, streaming to Jerusalem to learn from the God of Israel. At the end of this time, Satan will be loosed to deceive the earth once again, and the peoples of the earth will go into rebellion, many multitudes. So saying, hey, we don't want God, period. We just don't want him. We choose the flesh. We choose rebellion. And then we go into final judgment and the end of the age. So all that being said, James, Jacob, is reading this and saying, okay, in the future, there will be a restoration of David's fallen tent. All right, it's not primarily here talking about worship. It's been often applied to that tent of David and things like that in terms of worship. That's fine to make a spiritual application. But the point is that the reign of David, the rule of David, the calling of David will be fulfilled in the millennial kingdom with the Gentiles, right? Obviously through Jesus, the son of David, with the Gentiles, the Goyim, the nations of the world coming together to learn from the God of Israel. That's going to happen. James, Jacob sees this. Okay, Amos has prophesied that, but it's already broken in now. It's already happened now in this age. That's part of the genius of Paul, that he gets it, that which is promised for the future is already broken in now. We're in the messianic era, the first fruits of it through Jesus coming to the world, where Jew and Gentile can come together as one in Jesus, Yeshua. So he sees, hey, Amos was talking about this. We're now seeing this happen already. And the Gentiles do not have to become Jews to enjoy this. Bobby, Mark 9:24, I believe, help my unbelief. This is something that can encourage all of us, that we may not have perfect faith, that we may, Lord, I do believe, you know, I believe, I know, but I still struggle with unbelief. I wonder sometimes, you ever had that happen? God's given you a promise and you believe and you feel confident and you know that you know that you know that God is faithful. And yet sometimes you get hit with doubt, you waver. And what does Jesus do? Jesus heals the man's son. So there is a trust you can have in God that is a serious trust. And yet sometimes as a human being, you get hit with doubt, get hit with questions. For some, it happens more than others. And you just candidly say, Lord, the fact I'm talking to you, the fact I'm praying, the fact I'm reading your word, you know, I believe in you. Help my unbelief. Sometimes I don't fully believe. Sometimes I believe in spurts. Sometimes I believe, but I get plagued with these thoughts. Lord, help my unbelief. That's different than being an unbeliever. That's different from saying, God, I just don't trust you. I don't even know if you're there. Those are different attitudes. You say, yeah, but Jacob, James 1 tells us that the one who doubts is like a double-minded person. They're unstable in all their ways. That's really talking about being of two minds. I believe, I don't believe, I believe, I don't believe, I believe, I don't know, and making quality decisions for the Lord one day and then the wrong decisions the next because of unbelief. That's different than saying, God, I believe. It just, I'm with this unbelief. It plagues me sometimes. Those are really two very different things. I'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to today's Line of Fire broadcast. This is a travel day for me, day two of my journey to India. By the way, I come back over the weekend. India time, I should be arriving Wednesday afternoon. So left Monday afternoon, arriving India time Wednesday afternoon, about 40 hours door to door, about 10 and a half hour time difference from where I'll be in India. Well, all of India is the same time zone. It's just interesting, giant country with the same time zone. So about 10 and a half hours difference from, well, exactly 10 and a half hours difference from where I live in North Carolina over to time in India. You say, oh, I'd love to be in the meetings. These are not evangelistic campaigns we're doing or big open to the public meetings. These are meetings we do for leaders and friends there and participating in ministry school graduation, just some very, very special things that we do with some key people there. So we don't have it on our public itinerary for that reason. But please be praying for us, all right? And then Saturday, begin the journey back. And you pick up time coming back in with time zones and things like that and arrive home Sunday sometime. So travel days will just be over the weekend, God willing, back with you live, taking your calls the next day on Monday. Say, don't you need a rest day? Oh, we'll be good. We'll be good by God's grace. Hit the ground running. All right. There you go. About to give out the phone number. Could you just give out the phone number because we like hearing it? Yeah, 866-34-TRUTH, but don't call because this is a pre-recorded broadcast as I travel India. All right, back with your Facebook questions that I just asked for a few days ago, the things that trouble you, the things that you have a hard time with. Lolo says, love your enemies. Love your enemies. In the natural, that can be hard. Yep. In the natural, you have people that want to hurt you. You have people that lie about you. You have people that undermine many things that you do and create problems for you and maybe you're vicious and you love your enemies. Or maybe, you know, in the midst of war, that these enemies have killed family members of yours. How do you love your enemies? Supernaturally, only supernaturally. In the natural, all we're going to do is hate. In the natural, all we're going to do is want to see people suffer. Now, you can want to see justice. You can have a heart for justice and say, Lord, this isn't right. This just is not right. Bring about what's best. Bring about justice. That will still be different from the hatred that human beings would have for enemies. So as we receive God's love and remember that he loved us while we were enemies, while we were yet sinners, Messiah died for us, all right? While we were enemies in our mind because of wicked works, Ephesians 2 and Colossians 2, in the rebellion of our lives, that's when Jesus died for our sins. God looks at his enemies on the earth, and he sends his son to die for them. And then remember how ignorant we were, how foolish we were, how darkened we were, how ignorant we can still be at times, even as his children. And yet he had mercy on us. So you want to have mercy on others. Look, I was a poster boy for unhealthy eating almost my entire life. I could have eaten pizza and chocolate every day of my life for my entire life and not missed a beat. I would have been perfectly happy doing that. Really, sad to say. But that's the truth. That's the truth. I could live my whole life like that. And it's just unhealthy. I wasn't a glutton as much as a food addict, chocoholic and addicted to these other foods. And when God gave me grace, beginning August 24th of 2014, to change my lifestyle, completely transform my lifestyle, and now become a poster boy for healthy eating without exception now for 5 years and 3-4 months, and just enjoying the benefits of it every single day of my life by grace. But because I spent so many years knowing, okay, I should change my eating habits here. I need to cut out sweets here, do this, and try and fail or just improve here, but never really make the total radical change I needed to, that I have a lot of compassion on people who struggle. I was there for most of my life. Yeah, not a glutton, but just an unhealthy food eater. All right, and addicted to certain foods. So because of that, I have compassion. When I'm maybe at the airport, right, so I'm constantly at airports and constantly around just lots of people that I don't know, and I'll see some really heavy person trudging, you know, I walk right past them, they're trudging along slowly, I just feel bad for them. God help them. Immediately pray, God help them, just work in their lives. And so the same way I know the idiot that I was, the jerk that I was, the rebel that I was, the sinner that I was before I was saved, and God had mercy on me and was patient with me and sent Jesus to die for me in that state. So because he loved me, I now feel that same love for others. And I'm reminded of the fact that my judgment is an imperfect judgment, that my, well, God, give them what they deserve. That's a very imperfect judgment. Rather, Lord, have mercy. Have mercy. And I know people who've opposed me, come against me within the body. People have at times tried to hurt me, literally tried to hurt me, that God's put a love in my heart for them. And when I pray for them, I don't pray vindictive prayers. And that's why when some reach out years later and say, oh man, I'm so sorry, Mike, Dr. Brown, I'm so sorry, I misjudged you. It's like, hey, I'm good, man. I've never been mad at you. I've been praying for you the whole time, never been mad at you. And then those of you that experienced unbelievable hardship, I couldn't relate to, you know, someone killed a family member of yours, or some irresponsible 18-year-old drunk driver, you know, crashes into a vehicle and takes away three of your family members. And I can't imagine going through anything like that. But some of you will say, it's not in me, but something happened where God just gave me the grace to forgive that person and want to see them really repent and get their lives together. So there is that supernatural love that he puts in us. You look at it from the outside, can't understand it. Rachel, it's not a specific passage, but the whole Paul thing challenges my faith. Well, again, I have to read into what you mean by the whole Paul thing, but looking at your name, your first and last name looks like a Jewish name. Now, I don't know if that's your maiden name or if you married into Jewish. Let's just assume you're Jewish and wondering about this. The whole Paul thing, did Paul change things? Did Paul change the way Jesus started? Are there differences between Paul and Jacob, James, and the New Testament? How do we reconcile these things? I think the key thing that you need to understand, and I get into it in The Real Kosher Jesus, a section on Paul, where I refute and rebut my friend Rabbi Shmuley's reconstruction based especially on Chaim Maccabee's Paul the Mythmaker, that you have to understand that Paul was a real genius, Saul of Tarsus, Paul, a real genius, steeped in the scriptures, trained in rabbinic thinking, as we would call it in retrospect, right? So sitting under Pharisaical teaching. And in his brilliance, after the Lord reveals himself to him, just with the Hebrew Bible, and the Holy Spirit is able to understand all these majestic things about the meaning of the cross and the meaning of the resurrection and realities of his return. It's extraordinary. But he gets this understanding that Gentiles right now, not in a future age, but right now are heirs together with Jewish believers. That Gentiles in Jesus are heirs together with Jewish believers in Jesus. And that together, they stand as equals in the Lord. And that the Messianic era has broken in. So he's constantly speaking to Gentiles and warning against erroneous applications of Torah or being put under bondage to sign a covenant while he himself lives as a God-fearing Jew, as we see in the book of Acts. And so as a God-fearing Jew, why should he stop being a God-fearing Jew, a Torah-honoring Jew? Why should he stop doing that? For what purpose? And now he's understanding the new and better covenant that we live in where God puts his laws in our heart. But why should he stop being a God-fearing Jew? Right? Acts 23, when he's before the Sanhedrin, he says, I'm a Pharisee. Still, that's the group he identified with in terms of in the Jewish community, right? That's how he lived. But he's writing constantly to Gentile believers and showing how they can share together in the Messiah without themselves having to become Jews. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. So either Matthew 24:34, either Jesus is talking about the destruction of the first temple and those that are hearing him as he describes certain things that are going to happen with the destruction of the first temple in the year 70, that they're going to be alive to see it. You say, yeah, but then that would also mean the second coming because it mentions the second coming in that passage. So then Jesus came in the year 70. No, it's not what he's saying. He's answering several questions together. What will be the sign of this? When is this going to happen? Temple destroyed, and what's the sign of your coming of the end of the age? They thought it was all one and the same. It wasn't. But another way to read Matthew 24:34 is, yeah, there are a bunch of things that are going to happen, and there are a bunch of things that are going to happen that are going to happen in your lifetime, and you'll see with your own eyes. But there are other things that have to do with my return and with the end of the age. And when you, whoever it is, the you, whoever's alive at that time, when you see these things happen, when you see these things unfold, you who are alive then, you're going to see X, Y, well, then you're going to see Z also. So it's talking about that future generation. Now, a possibility I proposed to Craig Keenan the other day, and he had a chew on it. Maybe he was just being polite, but he had a chew on it. Could there be a double meaning? Matthew 24, speaking first of the destruction of the temple, those of you who see A, B, you'll also see C come to pass. But now, the end of the age, reading the same chapter, those of you who see X, Y, you'll also see Z. So those of you who see these first things, you'll see the destruction of the temple, this generation. At the end of the age, those of you who see these things, you'll see the second coming, this generation. You'll live to see it all. Could well be. But nothing contradictory.